Good evening.
Good evening.
I'm sure none of you have ever experienced this, and none of you wives have ever experienced your husband doing this, but at times, I have this tendency of just zoning out. And it's not necessarily when my wife is talking, which most people make a joke of. Oftentimes, it's my children. But I found it anytime. You know, I get interested in something, whether it's sometimes a television program, and those are the worst, because you end up wasting a lot of time that way. Time that you could have been spending elsewhere doing other things, and you just end up sitting there watching this TV program that really has no effect on you, that really doesn't matter in the grander scheme of things, and yet you waste all that time doing it. Or you do it with whatever. Sometimes I find myself just drifting off into thought and letting my mind wander. And sometimes I'm sure that my wife tries talking to me, and I'm sure after I've ignored her for a while because I'm totally zoned out, she'd like to do something. She'd like to slap me. And sometimes that's the only way you get people out of a situation like that, out of that zone. Oftentimes you see this very thing happening like in war movies. I've never seen it firsthand in war, but in war movies, a shell goes off next to a person and they've got what's called shell shock. And they're completely oblivious that they're in the middle of combat and people are shooting at them. And they're just kind of standing there. And they're kind of looking around. And always what the guy does, right, one of his compatriots comes up and bam, slaps the man. Snap out of it, right? Wake up. And so you have, in a spiritual way, this same principle going on. And as we've looked at before, we've seen through the book of Judges, as well as previously, and as if you've studied previous to Judges and Joshua, we see at the end of Moses' life that people start to deter a little bit. But even through Joshua's time and into the very beginning of when Joshua dies, and the elders who were with Joshua die, then that decline begins. The people start leaving God. And we've seen it progress and progress and progress. And something we have to notice is towards the end of Judges, you don't read a lot about God. You don't read a lot about people going to God in prayer. You don't read a lot about what God has to say about things. You read a lot about, hey, we want to do what we want to do, which is what we saw there at the end of chapter 18, chapter 17. We saw Micah coming up with this idea about a God and him establishing his son as a priest. And then he finds a Levite and he says, hey, you're going to be my priest now. I'm going to pay you this money. And the Levite says, yay. And then at the end of chapter 18, he says, well, God must be happy with this because I have a Levite as a priest. And we saw the problems that came from that. And the problems just keep compounding, even to the degree as we go forward, inevitably, to 1 Samuel chapter 2, verses 12 through 17, that Eli's sons, Eli's the high priest at the time of Samuel, and he's the one that trains Samuel, but his children are ridiculously terrible. They're bad. And they're serving in the temple, or not the temple, the tabernacle at the time. The temple hadn't been built yet. And they're serving in the tabernacle. And when people come to worship, and that's what it's describing there, the 12 through 17 of 1 Samuel chapter 2, when people come to honor God and to pay tribute to Him and to offer their sacrifices, they've got a hook that's bigger than it's supposed to be. God designated how big the hook was in the pot of meat that they were supposed to take out, and they've got a hook bigger than it's supposed to be. And then when people bring the best, right, the fat of their sacrifices, instead of them offering it to God the way they're supposed to, they pretend to offer it to God and instead keep it for themselves. And it even says there in verse 12, they didn't know the Lord. They didn't care about Him. And yet they're priests in the temple. Further along, it would talk about priests that would actually bring women to the door to lay with them. I mean, just the ridiculousness of their immorality and the things that they would do, it just keeps compounding and compounding and compounding. And here, in Judges chapter 19, I wondered for the longest time why in the world this was here. And the last preacher's meeting, I walk in, and of course we talk about, you know, various Bible passages and things like that, and we talk about what's going on in the community and whatnot, and all kinds of stuff. But the first thing, I go, how in the world do you preach Judges 19? How do you do that? And the other preachers, they hadn't dealt with Judges recently, so they're, you know, flipping them up. What, you know, what's he talking about? And her dad, of course, immediately goes, the Levite and his concubine. And I go, yeah! What in the world? Something we have to realize before we get into this is that this is history. These are things that actually happen, and that's one of the things that amazes me most about the Bible. When you talk about individuals, right, that write stories, people that write stories, authors, who tell these tales of heroes, they don't tell the bad parts about the heroes. They tell all the bad parts about the villains, and maybe the average man, but their heroes are pristine, they're clean, they have no problems. The Bible's not like that. Even when you talk about David, one of the greatest heroes in the entire Bible, he's got skeletons in his closet. He's got problems. And the Bible doesn't defer from them. It tells the truth of the matter. And here we're dealing with a people who have walked away from God to such a degree, their depravity is so thorough, so entrenched, that God's got to wake them up. He's got to slap them in the face. But he won't do it for a while. The saddest part is that this man, this Levite, it's not the same Levite as we were talking about before, it doesn't seem to be anyway, the way it begins chapter 19, seems like a different Levite, but he's in a bad place in his life. And the people around him are no better. Judges chapter 19, we talk about a Levite who takes a concubine. And in Judges 19 and verse 20, he talks about the relationship between his wife, or his concubine now, and his concubine's father. And there's a whole mess involved with that. We're going to focus on chapter 19 and verse 20 real quick. He says, "And the man said, and the old man said, 'Peace be with you, however, let all your needs be my responsibility. Only do not spend the night in the open square.' So he brought him into his house and gave fodder for the donkeys, and they washed their feet and ate and drank." Now, this Levite and his concubine are traveling from her dad's house back to his house, and they have to stop. And so they stop the way every pilgrimage or every traveler is supposed to, in the middle of town. And they're supposed to sit there in the middle of town, and someone, it's intended, is supposed to come to them and offer them a place to sleep for the night. And they're supposed to take care of everything that they need. That was the hospitality that was involved in the Jewish world. It was intended by God. And no one does. No one even looks twice at these individuals. They're just sitting there, obviously, hard up for a place to stay. And so this old man comes, and he wants to take care of them. "Oh, has nobody come to you?" he says. And they say, "No, no one. But we would even take care of our own responsibilities. I would pay you out of my pocket, basically, if we could just stay the night with you." And that's where we come here in verse 20. He says, "No, let your needs be my responsibility. Let me do what God called me to do." And so we see this man, and almost in the light of Ezekiel, where they were looking for one righteous man. And literally that was all they found in this entire city. And so as they go forward, verse 22, he says, "As they were enjoying themselves, suddenly certain men of the city, perverted men, surrounded the house and beat on the door. They spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, 'Bring out the man who came to your house, that we may know him carnally.'" This is very akin to what happens there in Genesis chapter 19 with Lot, as well as the angels that come to Lot's doorstep and the condemnation of Sodom and Gomorrah. And a similar thing transpires. But what happens is this man ends up giving his concubine to these people. And it says there in verse 25 that they knew her and abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. "Then the woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was till it was light. When her master arose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, there was his concubine fallen at the door of his house with her hands on the threshold." She made it all the way back and died on the doorstep. This depravity, this serious lack of respect not only for God but your fellow man or woman, this issue of immorality that exists in this community and seems to exist in almost all of Israel for quite a bit here. And he says, "When her master arose in the morning and opened the door of the house and went to go..." I already read that. In verse 28, "And he said to her, 'Get up and let us be going.' But there was no answer. So the man lifted her onto the donkey, and the man got up and went to his place. When he entered his house, he took a knife, laid hold of his concubine, and divided her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel." Now, if you stop right there, that's pretty gruesome. And that's really the point, it seems. The gruesomeness of what was needed to wake people up. Now, nowhere does God talk about whether he approved of such a behavior or not. He obviously didn't approve of the behavior of these individuals who came by night to this old man's house. But furthermore, it says nothing about whether he approved or disapproves of the things that are going on here. But in verse 30 it says, "And so it was that all who saw it said, no such deed has been done or seen from the day that the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, confer, and speak up." Now you've seen what kind of things have been going on in the land of Israel at this time. We've seen the depravity build and build and build to the degree that it rivals Sodom and Gomorrah. And these people, these Danites, or no, these Benjamites, there we go. These Benjamites, these people of Gibeah, they are on a rampage to do the most wicked of things. And it takes such a grotesque, such a ridiculous, such a... I can't even describe how bad this is. These people are so far gone that this is what it takes to get... not just the people in the city, the people in the rest of Israel to respond to this. To say, this is not something that is all right. This is unacceptable. And this is a nation that saw as they came into the land of Israel when they had a problem in Ai because Achan had stolen some things from Jericho, that the entire nation was defeated at Ai, even though Ai was a small place. Because there was sin in the camp. And they were supposed to work out the sin in the camp. They were supposed to deal with the sin that was going on. You find that even to the point of 1 Corinthians chapter 5. When a man is living in adultery with his father's wife. And they hadn't been doing anything about it. That even the Gentiles don't do that, he says. And you haven't been dealing with it. You've just been letting it happen. And it's leavening the whole lump, right? It's affecting everybody because of this. And it needs to be taken care of. It needs to be dealt with. And so we learn that depravity begets depravity. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 33, "Do not be deceived, evil company corrupts good habits." And folks, we need to be convinced of that. Because we've been deceived. We've been told that we can deal with whatever comes our way. But that's not always how the Lord wants us to respond. I'm sure Joseph could have thought that very thing when Potiphar's wife came on him and tried to have him lay with her. And yet, Joseph leaves his cloak with her and runs. He escapes. He finds that way of escape that needs to be found. Vice is most inflamed when men are companions in wickedness. And that's what we have here. We have a mob. We have a mob of men doing immoral things. Each tempts the rest by his example. Guilt appears to be lessened by being shared. That these individuals are sharing the guilt, and so no one feels it, the full brunt of what's going on. And they're able to do more depraved things and more depraved things because they're one-upping each other. And it's not that big of a deal to them because I'm only going a step further than the last guy. And we have that very problem here in America. And it's entrenched even into the church at times. Because things have become so normal out in the world. And we say, well, it's not that big of a deal. The Bible's against a lot of things that sometimes we say, well, that's not that big of a deal. How long before we get to this point? How long before we get to the point of Gibeah and we say, well, that's just ridiculous. We'll never get... yeah, we will. Because we'll always be one-upping ourselves. We'll always be going further than the line. Because once we step over that line, the next thing is to step just a little bit further. And just a little bit further. Because to us, the line keeps moving. The line doesn't move, friends. God established the line. And it stays where it is. He says, "Thus the greatest depravity is most often seen in cities in the concourse of many men. In the excitement of a mob, men will commit excesses from which they would shrink in solitary action. Yet responsibility is still individual and each man must ultimately answer for his own sins." But they don't care. They don't care. Psalm 1 in verse 1, he says, "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful." And if you look at those action words, you have walks, stands, and sits. You have a progression here. You have an individual who's walking by and sees some immoral people, right? Who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly. And it's not that big a deal that he's walking, but what does he do next? He stops and stands there. And fellowships with them, stands in the path of sinners. He says, nor sits, now he's seated with them, sits in the seat of the scornful. It's a progression, friends, and it's something that we have to realize is going on. We're so much like human history. They're just like we are, and we think we're immune to these things. We're immune to sin, we're immune to temptation, we're immune to all of the progression that goes on in the world. Even to the degree we call it progress sometimes. Yeah, progress, but in the wrong direction. Progress in the wrong direction. 2 Peter chapter 2. I want you to notice what is said about that similar passage in Genesis 19. 2 Peter chapter 2, in verse 6, he says, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, right? Fire running down from heaven. Condemn them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly. Now, that's the Gibeonites, friends. And delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked. For that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. And we know how Lot got there. Abraham and Lot were together at one time. Their flocks dwelt together. And Abraham and Lot grew so prosperous together that they had to divide. And so Abraham, being a very nice uncle, allowed Lot to decide where he would go. And he picked in the direction of Sodom. Now when it happened, it wasn't that big of a deal, because he was outside of Sodom. But then the Bible tells us that he continued to pitch his tent towards Sodom to the degree that he didn't need to pitch his tent anymore because he lived in Sodom. And we say, well, why would he do that? We know why he'd do that. Because that line kept blurring. And he'd get closer and closer to the city. Closer and closer to the, maybe the sinfulness, maybe it was enticing him, but nothing else. He kept moving towards the city. Something that he really shouldn't have been doing. But it didn't just torture his soul. Because at the end of chapter 19, Genesis chapter 19, verses 30 through 38, his daughters commit unspeakable immorality. Where do you think they learned that? They dwelt in Sodom, and their souls were tormented by the things they saw and heard. It affects us, and it affects our families. And yet we let it remain. Now there is a degree to which I understand the Amish community. They say, we're going to detract ourselves from the media. We're going to detract ourselves from, and while they take it to an extreme extent, I think, to a degree, you know, they give up all electricity. Because if you don't have electricity, you can't have a television. I'm not sure that television shouldn't be booted. You think of the things that we watch on it. The immorality that goes on that we just allow to exist in our households. And we want to keep our children from it sometimes. Sometimes we don't. But then what are we doing with it? Ingesting it. And that line keeps getting drawn back. And drawn back. And drawn back. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 8 actually gives us what we need to focus on. We spend so much time in front of the television. So much time doing things that seem so important to us. And yet Philippians 4 and verse 8 says, finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue. Notice that. If there is any virtue, and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. See, he gives us the idea. He gives us the things that we need to meditate on. We need to be involved in, invested in. The things we need to put our time towards. And yet we sit there and even if there's nothing bad on television, there's rarely anything good. Rarely anything good. And yet we put ourselves in front of it, and it takes up so much of our time, and we have so little time, we say, for all the things that are good, and all the things that are noble, and all the things that are praiseworthy, and all the things that really matter to God. And we make so many excuses. And we say we have so little time. We still have time for immorality and iniquity. And you know what? Sometimes, friends, it takes extreme measures. A slap in the face. A slap in the face from God, and you say, that's not what I want. Sometimes it is what you want. Sometimes it is absolutely the thing that you need. Because what's the alternative? If you're on the wrong track and God doesn't slap you square in the face, you're going to end in destruction. You take a little pain right now, and you make the corrections necessary, and you stave off destruction. Or if you ignore God, right, as He calls to you, and you get angry at Him when He slaps you, and you continue right down that road to hell. That's where we're going, folks. Genesis 6, verses 5 through 7. God slapped the earth with the flood. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was on evil continually. We say, I can't imagine that. Yes, I can. I see that sometimes in the world. I see it sometimes in people even. That they can't think of anything that's not evil. They can't think of anything that's not evil. And the Lord was sorry that He had made man on the earth, and He was grieved in His heart. Is the Lord grieved with your life? Is the Lord grieved that you're living the life the way you want to live it? Doing the things that you want to do? Genesis 19, He destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah because of the immorality, the iniquity that was going on there. Habakkuk 1 through chapter 2 and verse 8 is the destruction of Jerusalem by the Chaldeans, and I love that. The first four verses is Habakkuk saying, Lord, why in the world are these people not being taken care of? And by that he means, why aren't you slapping them around, Lord? They're in all kinds of immorality. They're torturing me, Lord. They're doing all kinds of bad things. Why aren't you taking care of them? And the Lord then, verse 5, says, oh yeah, well, Chaldeans are coming. They're terrible people. They're ridiculously mean. Horrible, horrible people. Yeah, I'm bringing them. They're going to destroy him. Yeah, that's what's going to happen. And Habakkuk says, no, you can't do that. What in the world are you doing? Now, I like chapter 2 and verse 1 because he says, now, you'll correct me. Habakkuk's like, yeah, I probably spoke out of turn there. You'll correct me. And the Lord says, yeah, but don't worry, because after I'm done with the Chaldeans, they've got their place. They've got their place too. Slaps in the face. Luke chapter 15, verse 16. The prodigal son, right? I love that, comes to himself. He's about to eat pig slop. Ah, I can't believe it. Yeah, I can. Happens all the time. And he would gladly have filled his stomach, verse 16, with the pods that the swine ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger? So what is that? It's a slap in the face. You're about to eat hog slop, and you go, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of. So I gotta go home. Ain't all he better as my father's servant? In Acts 2, in verse 37, verse 36, when Peter says, let all the house of Israel know assuredly that this Jesus whom you crucified, God has made both Lord and Christ. And there, in Acts chapter 2, and verse 37, it says, they were cut in their hearts. They were cut in their hearts. That's what we need. We need that wound that won't close. Because we do it for a while, and then we feel bad about it, and then we're done with it. And we always say, well, don't feel bad. No, you should feel as bad as you should feel. Now, some people go too far, and they feel so much worse than they should. The Lord has taken care of that. The Lord has forgiven you of your sins if you are penitent of that, of repentant of the sins that you commit and you come to Him on His terms. The Lord forgives you of those things. So get over it. But then on the other side, sometimes we're not hard enough on ourselves and we pass over sins that only God has the ability to do. We say, well, that's not that big of a deal. Oh, that won't cost me eternity. They were cut to their heart. And that is what inspired the change in them. That is what brought them to God in the first place. And that was what created that relationship. That made that relationship possible. Because they were cut in their hearts. Matthew chapter 23. Notice the words that Jesus uses for the Pharisees. You have to go from beginning of 23 to the end of 23. But he says, hypocrites, blind guides, fools, whitewashed tombs full of dead men's bones, serpents, brood of vipers, he calls them murderers. Now there's a time where Jesus is, to a degree, politically correct, right? He's not this harsh for a while. But chapter 23, you're dealing with the end of his life. He doesn't have long on the earth. And he puts all the cards on the table. Are we prepared for the Lord to do that with us? Are we prepared for the Lord to do that with us? I don't think so. I don't think we are. We get into the judgment and we deal with those books that are sitting there. Are we going to go, are we going to contest some of those things? Good luck with that. Now contest the books that the Lord opens. It's not going to work for you. Hypocrites, blind guides, fools, whitewashed tombs full of dead men's bones, serpents, brood of vipers, murderers. And all of this, all of these things is intended to bring a response. But not just any response, because you slap somebody in the face, chances are you'll get a response. Oftentimes it's not the response you were looking for. But it's a response. These Gibeonites, if you look forward to chapter 20, these Gibeonites do not like that the people of Israel are clamoring against them, and they come in force to deal with them, and they go to war with them, and they get utterly annihilated, literally just beaten up. So the response isn't always what you're looking for. But the point of what this man did, what this Levite did, was not for the Gibeonites. It was to wake up the people of Israel. Now, it obviously didn't work all that well. It didn't work as well as God would have probably liked it to work. God would like them to make reparations, to transform themselves into the people of God once more, and they failed to do that. But it brought an appropriate response in relation to the sins and iniquities that these people were performing. And then in Acts chapter 2 and verse 38, he tells you the appropriate response. And we notice that it's often clear. It's far clearer than when you were standing there, right, googly-eyed, looking into the abyss. It's far clearer than what you thought before you got slapped in the face. Acts chapter 2, verse 38, he says, they say, men and brethren, what shall we do? And he says, repent and let every one of you be baptized in the name of Jesus for the remission of your sins. He says, change. That's not that hard to figure out. That's not difficult. If you're doing something wrong, and you come to that realization, quit doing it. And do the right thing. And so the appropriate response when we're dealing with sin is oftentimes clear. It's usually that we don't want to do it. It's usually the slap in the face is not quite enough to get us motivated to do the right thing. To continue in God's will. Or even to start it. If you have friends that influence you poorly, evil company corrupts good habits. He says, quit hanging out with them. If you are not able to influence your friends, instead they influence you, then you're in a bad relationship and you need to cut ties. And yet we stay in those situations. We stay in those relationships, hoping and dreaming that we'll inevitably become strong enough to deal with them. No, if they're sacrificing your eternity, there's an issue. Romans chapter 12, verse 2. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove that which is good and acceptable and perfect will of God. And you say, man, that's too extreme. Think about the situation you're in. If you're walking away from God, you're already extreme. You're already living on the edge. But it's not the edge you're looking for. It's not the exciting thing. It's the scary part. It's the scary part of extreme, because you're on the precipice of hell. You're about to fall in. It's like those trucking shows where they drive in these crazy places and they're teetering on the edge and they're driving their truck and they got this much right clearance on the side. And if they do something wrong, they're in. That's where you're at. And God's giving you a side road to take you where you need to be. Where the roads are really wide. Where there's plenty of room for you. But you've got to take his hints, and you've got to take his commands, and you've got to do what the Lord requires. And you say, that's too extreme. And I would propose there is nothing too extreme. So those war movies, they always talk about by any means necessary, right? You take that hill, by any means necessary. You accomplish such and such a goal, by any means necessary. That's the way we should be about our salvation. By any means necessary. Well, there's only one way. Jesus, John chapter 14, and verse 6 says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except by me. By any means necessary would mean that you do it according to God's will. That you go through Jesus in order to find your way to God. Matthew chapter 5. Few people ever consider that Matthew 5, right, 29 and 30, is not necessarily just metaphoric. You ever think about that? 29:30, he says, "If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you, for it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for the whole body to be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you, for it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell." And we say, well, that's metaphoric. It means that when you're doing something wrong, and there's a sin in your life, or there's something that's going on, maybe a friend, right, that you break ties with that friend. But look at the context. If you back up to verse 27, he says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not commit adultery,' but I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery in his heart." How do you fix that? You got a wandering eye, and you can't resolve that through patience and working that out? Is it completely within your right and within reason? You might say no. Think about it. Completely within reason that if you can't absolve that sin from you, that if you can't work that out and you keep struggling with it, that you go blind for the rest of your life, that you might inherit eternity? And if you're saying no, what's sight compared to eternity in heaven? What's sight compared to eternity in heaven? Because you'll get the sight back. You'll be healed. You'll get that new body. But only if you make it to heaven. He said, your right hand. And if you back up 10 more verses, if a man hates his brother, he's a murderer. What do you do with that right hand? You're metaphorically killing people. Maybe you're smacking somebody. Matthew chapter 19, verses 9 through 12. Talking about marriage and remarriage. And I love what they say there. I love the disciples' response. Matthew chapter 19. Because it's not what we expect. In verse 9 he says, "And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery." His disciples said to him, "If such is the case of a man with his wife, it is better not to marry." And you expect Jesus to say, no, it's good to marry. Yes. Pro-marriage. He doesn't do that. He says, but he said to them, "All cannot accept this saying, but only those to whom it has been given." Isn't that weird? "For there are eunuchs who were born thus from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men." Notice the third one. "And there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He who is able to accept it, let him accept it." He says some people are born that way. And some people, especially there in the first century, but it even happens today, through accident, sometimes on purpose, but most of the time on accident, that individuals are made eunuchs by men. He says there's a third option, though. Some make themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. And we say that is too extreme. And Jesus says, that's what some people do. Not all are given the ability to not be married. He says, that's not too extreme. That's not too extreme. Now, in today's society, might people think you odd if you cast your eyes away? Yeah. Might you spend the rest of your life in an insane asylum? Potentially. But is your sight worth heaven? Is your ability to marry worth heaven? Is anything in this earth worth heaven? The Lord says nothing is worth heaven. Nothing can be exchanged for your soul that you would make a good deal on. And yea, even you could have everything in this world. You could trade your soul for everything in this world. And you've made a shoddy deal. You've made a shoddy deal. But we don't get that. We don't recognize that. Because it's been a while since we've recognized the Lord slapping us in the face. It's been a while since we've recognized we've been cut to the heart. You remember the first time you sinned? Right after you came out of the baptistry. And I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was like, because you always do that. We talked about that when Brother Lenny was baptized. And how it felt to come out of the water and you just felt clean. And then you messed up. And for some, it could have been a day, and I don't think it was for me. I think it was pretty close to like right after. And then you just felt terrible. Why don't we feel that way anymore when we sin? Why don't we feel bad when we commit iniquity? when our sin causes God pain. Why? Because we've been desensitized to it. Because we draw ourselves away from it as often as possible. Because we don't like to think about it. Because we don't like unpleasant things. And yet a slap in the face is sometimes exactly what we need. People don't like to be confronted when they sin. And sometimes that's the slap in the face, and sometimes they freak out. But if you do it in a loving manner, it's still a slap in the face. But sometimes it's for the purpose of helping someone regain eternity. And that, my friends, is always worth it. If you this night are not in a relationship with the Lord, if you've never been in a relationship with the Lord, you can do as those in on the day of Pentecost did. If you were cut in your heart, whether it is today or it's midnight tonight or it's 3 days from now, or friends, if you've been given that much time a year from now, whenever it is, if you become cut in your heart that the Lord has put it in you that you need to change your life in relation to His will, and you want to be baptized for the remission of your sins as those on the day of Pentecost were, to be in keeping with the Lord's commands, to obey Him in everything that you do, you can ask. And I don't care what time it is. I don't care what day it is. I don't care when it is. You can be saved today. And if you have walked away from God, if you've given up your place in His kingdom, and you've become entrenched with the world, and you've let it well up around you like those thorns that choke out the Word, I've got a weed whacker. We can take care of those things. And this congregation can work with you, and they can pray for you, and we can help you get out of that mess. And if you need the help or the prayers of the congregation, for whatever reason, it's through an issue of a lack of strength in the Lord. Perhaps it's problems with your family. Maybe it's difficulties at work. It doesn't matter what it is. You have a family here that cares about you and wants to see you with them in eternity in heaven. And we'll do whatever we can by any means necessary. Just as the Lord did. It wasn't His first choice to give His Son on the cross, but it was what was necessary. And the Lord gave it freely. Whatever you need, I pray that you would come while we stand and while we sing.